Hello and welcome to another exciting and jam-packed episode of Modern Day Philosophers. I am your host. I am Danny Lobel. I am broadcasting live from Jerusalem. That's right. I'm in Jerusalem. And it feels good. It is nice to be here. You know, it's a beautiful city. The air is sweeter. It's very nice people. The food tastes very good. Today I spent the day walking around the old city. I visited the Western Wall, I visited the City of David, I walk around the tunnels, I did a lot of hiking, I'm doing good exercise, I'm eating very well here, and it's been good, very good experience for me. I'm learning a lot of Judaism. The people in my program are very, very intellectual, I gotta tell you that. I feel a little bit stupid, but it's alright, I'm keeping up. But these other guys on the program, they're bringing up all kinds of questions, like bringing in quantum physics and all kinds of stuff. It's interesting because they're asking the rabbis questions that I would never even, you know, I'm not smart enough to ask, or I'm not informed enough to ask. And I like the fact that they're asking them, and I could sit back and be like, I'm not even sure what scientific theory he's bringing in here, but let's see how they answer it. And it's been very interesting. And there's one guy on the program who found out that I have a philosophy podcast, and he's like, oh, I'm very into philosophy, and so he starts talking philosophy to me on a level that I don't even understand. You know, I've got a long way to go on this podcast before I can really say I know philosophy on any level, but I said, well, who's your favorite philosophy? And what do you know? It was Wittgenstein. How do you like that for coincidence? The very guy, Carlos Alazraki, and I discuss him on today's show. So I didn't sound like a complete dummy when he brought it up because I was able to say things that I knew from the show. And he's like, oh, you do know your stuff. And I was like, well, not really, but I didn't tell him to the extent of how limited my knowledge is. I guess, you know, after 52 episodes or so of this show, I probably know more than most people, unless those people are into philosophy on a serious level, in which case, I don't know. But I'm learning. I think, you know, hopefully we're all learning something here. And I'm learning a lot out here in Israel, and I'm enjoying my 3 weeks here on the program. Now, a quick word about this episode. The audio is a bit blown out for the first 4 or 5 minutes of the show, something like that. So I almost sound like I'm delivering my questions to Carlos as you might hear a pilot on an airplane talk to you. But it gets better after that, a lot better. So if you don't focus in on it and just listen to the show, before you know it, the audio will be fine. And it's a good one. I think it's a really good episode. I think you're going to enjoy it. Happy New Year, everybody. By the way, I wish I had one of those things. I don't know. Does that sound like it? One of those things and you get, and it blows out, and then, you know, and then you're wearing a party. Anyway, you know what I mean. I'm trying to wish you a Happy New Year. Happy New Year, everybody. And may it be a great year full of success for all of you, and good times, and good things happening in all your lives. Thank you for tuning into this show. And thank you to our sponsor, Mr. Dan Schlissel, for continuing to support this show. Here's a quick word from him and Stand Up Records.
Imagine a world where no one ever went hungry, where you didn't have to choose between clean air and clean water, and where bitter, drunken comedians didn't have to work in small, dark clubs to tell you how severely screwed up everything is. If that kind of world scares you the way it scares us, then we can help. We're StandUpRecords.com. We offer the finest in CDs, DVDs, and merchandise from the best stand-up comedians on earth. So please give generously, and remember, together we can't save the world. Yeah, no, we can't. So you may as well just buy something funny. That's StandUpRecords.com.
There you have it. Dan Schlissel and Stand Up Records. Dan is the best. Thank you, Dan. Thank you for supporting this year of Modern Day Philosophers. And thank you to everybody out there who has supported the show. Every one of you who's made a donation, or if you've left a nice comment on iTunes and a 5-star rating, or if you took the time to write me an email this year. Thank you very, very much for doing that. It really means a lot to me. I can't even express it. Just whenever I open my email and there's an email from somebody in there who listens to the show, it really makes my day. And sometimes my week and my month, and cumulatively it makes my year. So thank you for making this a great year. Thank you for supporting the show. I hope you continue to support the show going into 2015. Of course, the website is moderndayphilosophers.net. You can make a donation, and it would go a long way towards keeping this going. So please do that. All right, everybody, without further ado, except for the intro song, my talk with the great Carlos Alazraki.
Hello, and welcome to Modern Day Philosophers.
Modern Day Philosophers.
Having failed to pay attention in school, Danny Lobel, now older and wiser, will attempt to learn basic philosophy 101. Our young hero will be joined by today's top comedians, philosophers all their own. Ladies and gentlemen, here's Danny Lobel.
Modern Day Philosophers.
Welcome, I'm here with Carlos Alazraki.
Yes.
And we're in your beautiful backyard in Burbank.
There are literally birds chirping. The sun is out. It's probably 70 degrees.
It's a beautiful day, and we're surrounded by orange trees and lemon trees.
It is so quintessentially Los Angeles.
Yeah, it feels like it, yeah.
Rolling hills. You can see the Burbank, the Warner Brothers building from here. From upstairs, you can see the tower. Just not to give away my location, but you can see the hills behind the Warner Brothers building. Mm. It's pretty neat. It kind of almost takes you back to, like, suddenly it's like the 1940s, and there's orange orchards, and there's lots of parks, actually. And you discover that when you have kids. You're like, you got to get to a park. And you go, oh, there's a playground there. There's a playground here. There's a playground there. So we're pretty lucky.
I wanted to bring that up also because you just had, and I appreciate you doing this with me so soon after just having another kid.
It's kind of interesting, yeah. It's, you're in a definitely a sleep-deprived state. I was convinced that I had left my wallet somewhere, and I left it upstairs on a dresser behind a doll, which is, when you roll back, we all go through that. It's like, how did that consciously get there? I will set it behind. When my first daughter was born, I couldn't find my cell phone for over an hour, and it was in the refrigerator, which means I had a moment where I took something out of the refrigerator, took the cell phone out of my hand, placed it on a shelf, and left it there. Just because you're just, whatever works when you have kids, whatever works to get you to the next moment, 16-minute nap with me, a half a five-hour energy and a dark chocolate piece in my mouth, and it gets me going again.
Would you be considered an old dad?
I guess so, yeah. You know, I'm 51, and, you know, by today's standards, it's changing. I think people are waiting later. They're waiting to have their careers and travel, have multiple marriages before they have kids. But on average, well, yeah, I think I would be considered to be older. I'm in shape. There's definitely, you don't have the age, the energy that you did 20 years ago.
Are you happy with how you did it, or do you regret not being a dad younger?
There's some regrets in terms of physical energy, but in terms of my emotional and psychological makeup, I'm glad I waited. Because I would have probably done things much more incorrectly back then. So if you can get to a perspective where you want to be a father and you want to be a husband and you want to be invested in all this, I say that in my act. It was one of my first lines. It's like the more that you're invested in your family as a husband and a father, the harder it is to get up and get out of the house and go do comedy. Because I look at my wife and she gets it, and I say, honey, I'm sorry, I'm enjoying this, we're having a great day and a great evening, but I got to get up and go to the improv. I love you. And I look at my 2.5-year-old and I go, Riley, she's almost there. And I go, daddy loves you, but not as much as I love the acceptance of total strangers. So I must leave the house to go get that adulation that you can't provide.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, that's the joke, you know, that's the balance. And I think when you're younger and you're an artist and it's all about you, it's me, 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 and fame, and I want to be noticed, it's all about me. It's hard to give over and give to a family. And now that, you know, I read, just before my second daughter was born, I read the Rolling Stone special on Pink Floyd. I'd never known the Sid Barrett years, but I was always a non-pot smoker, never smoked pot, but just a big fan of Dark Side of the Moon and Roger Waters. And you know, you get to that point where, yeah, you're shorter of breath and one day closer to death. And so you start to ponder, what's it all about? Is show business super important? It's all made up. It's just made up. All these awards. Here's an award for doing stuff that's based on fantasy. And so you go, yeah, being a dad and being a husband and being a father, that's all real. And now, you know, I want to balance this. I still want to be creative and do all these things, but do I need to walk down red carpets every day and have an entourage and be super famous? No. And I agree with Colin Cowherd, the sportscaster. All I want to do is be successful enough to buy into a private jet company where I can fly my family anywhere without having to go through security. I don't think that's akin to wanting to be famous. Like, I don't.
Right.
Hell no. I just want a private jet.
Yeah. At least get a pilot's license.
I could. My wife won't let me. This is coming from somebody who used to jump out of planes, but she's afraid that that's not a good thing to do. Yeah. I want to be Travolta, you know, try, mm-hmm. fly jets.
What makes that real? When you talked about having kids and a wife, you said that's real, whereas the other stuff isn't real. And I think I know what you mean, but I...
Yeah, it's a relative word, isn't it? Grounded, I guess, is a better word. You're right, because being in show business is a reality. I suppose attaching... I guess what makes it more quote-unquote real is attaching your goals to the outcome of making your family stronger and your kids grow up in a good, safe environment, as opposed to me trying to get an award, you know, winning an award for something, an Annie or chasing an Oscar. That would be sort of, I think, less real in the relevant scope of life. It would be, it's real, but maybe it shouldn't be as important. But I think if you're single and you don't have kids, why not? Maybe what's real in either case should be the pursuit, right? They always say don't attach your goal to an end result. So maybe what's real is the journey. So in that case, we come full circle and say that both things can be real. The journey's real.
Are you not jumping out of planes anymore because you're a father now?
I think so. Because I got older, went through therapy and talked about it. What was the reason I was jumping out of planes, per se?
Can you share it?
I think it was to be bigger than my problems and to say that, boy, if I can jump out of a plane, then I'm cooler than you and you can't scare me. And it was all about being big and trying to not deal with things. Fun. Not all skydivers do it for that reason. But I think my friend Colin Reno had shared the same experience, that if we could just jump out of planes, it makes us somehow death defiers, makes us more special. So I think that's why I was jumping out of planes. And there are times that it's just, I can't replace it. I go to the iFly tunnel now, mm-hmm. where you just go in the tunnel and get your time and sure. no parachute. And it's a worthy substitute, but nothing close to when a tailgate on a Skyvan opens up and you're going, all right, that's it. And you just jump into nothing with a friend. Or I jumped out of a hot air balloon. Mm-hmm. You can't replace that experience. But now, because I'm more, the pun would be, grounded with family and kids, mm-hmm. I let it go. You still miss it and you still literally dream about it, because that feeling is indelible. It's in you. You have these in-air dreams, but eh.
So it was kind of like a rebellion against your own mortality.
I think so, yeah. That's a succinct way to put it.
Do you think maybe on some level having kids kind of gave you some immortality that you were looking for, which also satisfied that urge?
Yeah, it definitely gives you that. I mean, what energy you do get is because of that. You feel, okay, I'm here, I need to provide for them, and I want to watch them grow, and I want to be there, I want to get in shape now. So physically speaking, I want to get in better shape, I want my heart to be okay, I'm taking my Bayer aspirin.
Right.
You know, I've known people that are younger than me that have had heart attacks. We were just talking about that on a Bayer audition the other day, actually. So, yeah, they keep you going. They give you a new life force energy.
I think, like, art and having kids, I think there are other ways people try to be immortal, but I mean, you're doing two of them.
Yeah.
I mean, just the idea of not wanting to die. We really just want to make sure that this existence has significance.
Yeah.
Past, I wonder how long, like, say Woody Allen, he's put out a lot of work. He's made an impact.
Yeah.
Let's say his work lasts for 200 years before it's forgotten. That's 200 extra years of life almost after he died.
Yeah, I guess so.
So maybe at this point I get about 6 months.
Yeah.
where I'm at. I might have an extra 6 months of people remembering my stuff where I'm at right now.
That's pretty good.
So
I might have a few years in there.
Actually, you know? Well, if he only gets 200, I don't think 6 months, maybe 6 weeks. I think the proportions are off there, but
I think that's where I've been lucky with voiceover work. Even Reno 911, it lives on. And with Netflix, we might get a show that Netflix will take it beyond what we've expected. But
oh, great.
Animation lives on. You know, there will always be a classic turn of the millennium, almost in the 90s, for Nickelodeon with Chris Vellucci, started with Ren and Stimpy, and then we followed with Rocco's Modern Life. That's such a, that's, it's almost the animation equivalent of the rock and roll 60s. There was a really big change to really cool animation, you know, which was born out of the Tex Avery stuff and animators really wanting to copy that. But so that stuff is indelible. I just went to, I posted it on Facebook. I went the other day to Not Just Another Burger Stand on Mariposa and Riverside and Burbank, because they had a little chalk sign out there that said, be the voice of Rocco, or do the voice of Rocco, get a 10% discount. Be Carlos Salas Rocky, get free food. And so I just showed up that day and I was like, hey, I think I can do Rocco. And I met Matt and Matt. I did not meet Lisa, who made the board, or Liza. But that was cool to see something that...
And you had no idea they were going to do that.
Yeah, this cartoon's been off the air since 95, and yet there are still fans of it. And so hopefully, you know, people will go back and go, oh, that's not a cartoon. Back in my day, Rocco's Modern Life, or my, you know, show your grandkids that kind of stuff.
When did you start doing impressions?
I don't know. I think early on when I was a kid, I started imitating my best friend's parents. John Haney. He was from Scotland, you know, and I heard my mom, Carlitos, no me digas. So I started imitating people at about 6 years old. And then I think I was trying to do Herman Munster when I was about 10. Lily, I won't, I won't, I won't. So probably about between 6 years old is when it started, and then it started blossoming around 10 or 11.
What do you think is the distinction between a good impression and a great impression?
Is when you start to not care what is being said by the impressionist. You're just like, that's it. That's the person. So, yo, bitch, if I'm reading a phone book, Heisenberg comes after hell. Whoa, Mr. White, hopefully, you know, you won't, it doesn't matter what I say. I just have the intonation, cooking. You know, that kind of thing. I was watching Frank Caliendo today doing John Gruden and doing John Madden and Peter Berman. Tonight's 2-minute blitz. And you're just watching him, and it doesn't matter what you're he's saying. He's so good. That's the difference between a great impressionist. It goes beyond the material.
Were there breakthroughs?
Specifically with Billy Crystal, me doing the merchandise for Monsters, Inc., it was something that somebody encouraged me to audition for. Listen, we need a sound-alike voice to do Mike Wazowski because Billy Crystal's busy, not going to want to do all the stuff. And I'm like, I don't do Billy Crystal. And somebody said, no, you're a tenor. Brian Monroe, I think a Disney character, said, you are a tenor. You're in his range. You should study it. And all right. So I bought Forget About Paris in one weekend and started watching a movie. He's talking to the old man. Will you shut up for a while? You know, he started to be, I watched the way his mouth moved, you know, Pick a Pepper and Harold Nutsella. You pretty much want to nail them too. And then I started to, you know, get it and pitch it and high and match it. Oh, Sully, we got to get out of here. Monsters, Inc. That thing is a killing machine. I started to get it. And then the more I did it, the better I came.
A lot of it is watching the mouth move itself.
It's the physical mouth movement. Yeah, it's watching somebody's face. You know, when you do De Niro, you do the face, I hit things. You know, when you do young Pacino, his mouth doesn't open that much. Don't do that to me. Fredo, what are you doing? I knew it was you. You broke my heart, Fredo. Titus Wolliver is an actor who does great impressions, and the three different stages of Al Pacino is phenomenal. But, yeah, it's watching the mouth. When I did John Heaney, I thought, stiff upper lip, it never moved, Catalyst. You and Kevin go outside and you play basketball, and you don't bring that inside. You know, it was the way the mouth moved. And that helps a lot.
Do you try to become the person in your head when you're doing it?
Yeah. You know, when I first started doing Mike Wazowski, I thought, okay, I'm Billy Crystal, and I'm doing a green guy that's higher pitched up. And then after about 20 sessions, I was not even thinking about Billy Crystal. I was thinking about Mike Wazowski and his little lip flap. Oh, boy. What are we going to do, Sully? We're in trouble. We got to leave. Ah. So I started to think about this green thing and the way it moved.
Yeah.
So Billy Crystal was gone.
I spoke to someone else who does. Do you know Melissa Villaseñor?
Oh, yeah, she's great.
So she told me that for her to do an impression of somebody well, she has to like the person. Is that true for you?
I think so. Yeah, there's something indelible about Aaron Paul. Yo, let's do this. Yeah, he's really... I think I would agree with that, yeah. I would agree with that. I forget I used to do, yeah. Used to do the other ones. Oh, you do. I think of my act about meeting my wife for the first time is 20 years younger. Marty, why are we going back in time, Marty? It's 1982. Where are we, Doc? We're at the hospital. Why, did I injure myself playing soccer? No, we're going to meet your wife. Here she comes, Marty. She's coming down the canal. You're going to marry this girl, Marty. You know, yeah, you definitely have to like something about that person.
Do you think you can think as them when you're doing the impression?
I think you have to almost, you know, just to make it good.
Do you think you could have an original thought as another person?
I think that's what you, that's the attempt when you're acting to do that. You know, I did with Garcia when I was doing, that was an impression of somebody on Reno 911. So yeah, I think to the extent that I was doing him five days a week for a couple weeks at a time and then doing it for five seasons, I think I did give him some original thoughts. It was an impression of somebody else that existed. And well, I don't know. He'd have his attitudes and it started to happen. You have hero characters that you do.
Rocco is sort of cool, you know. When he did Rocco, he's always a can-do guy, and he'd get frustrated, but he was always full of hope.
And so, you're like, you know, Rocco's cool. There's part of that in Rocco. There's part of that in me. Why not? So I think, yeah, and the reverse can happen, too. You inject what you have into a character. But so, yeah, sometimes a character can, yeah, sometimes you want to walk around and go, yo, bitch, shut up, and feel good about yourself. I used to do a bit about having a pocket New Yorker on my shoulder to make me feel less guilty. When you watch The Sopranos, that's what's so attractive about it. They're all it. There's no apology from Tony Soprano. You fucking motherfucker. You fucking do that again, I'm going to fucking choke you. Let's go have a steak. And they don't feel guilty. That's beautiful. I want to feel that. How do you do that?
But
how
he kind of did feel guilty. That's why he was in
a therapy. A little bit of therapy. I fucking fucked up the fucking ducks in my pool.
You know... But there's other people that can just, yeah, float through life and that you want to emulate. You want to emulate cool, you know, the world's most interesting man. You know, that's a fun character to play. Who doesn't want to be that guy?
Right.
Let's get off my back. I'm here at a bar. I'm hanging out.
You ever slip out of character?
Oh, yeah. There was times I slipped out of character for sure.
How do you keep that from happening?
Well, with voiceover stuff, when we're in recording, you have little leaders that bring you back in. For Billy Crystal, I was getting too muppety or up here, like, ah, sorry, it would be like, you're married, which was a line from the movie, Forget About Paris. I know you don't want to tell me everything, but all I do know is you got four brothers with bad ears, you got two this, and oh, yeah, you're married. So you're married would always bring me back to getting into that vocal character. Sometimes Garcia would slip because I'd want to do something else with him, and I go, you know what, that's not really what Garcia's about. Mm-hmm. He's uptight. He's got rigid rules, and he just doesn't like change. And sometimes I'd try to be too cool and slip out of it a little bit and have to reel it back in.
Can he evolve in his own therapy, Garcia? Can he change? Can he have a revelation?
I think he might have a revelation. I'm paying too much for this crap. But no, I don't think he could. I don't think it's possible. I think it's too closed off for him.
So you have to keep the depth limited in a way to keep the character alive.
Yeah, with him, he's a small town sheriff who watches Wheel of Fortune by himself, goes to bowl with his buddy back in the day, and for him, his scope of philosophy or emotional development was not that broad. Mm-hmm. There's black and white, you know,
right.
And I got a black partner.
There's nothing more to him that hasn't uncovered.
He's sad. There's some sadness there for sure, which is covered up by Agner being angry and uptight. Trying to figure out if that's my wife in the Kia. But, oh yeah, she's taking both girls to my daughter's preschool. There's some sadness with Garcia that would seep out every other time. He'd cut him open and go, okay, well, if you don't want me to go, then I won't. So that would come through.
What is it about doing these impressions that you love the most?
I don't know. It's maybe living vicariously through that other character as we talked about. But seeing people react too and go, oh, wow, that's good. It's cool. You know, it's that collective unconscious, right? If everybody's walking Breaking Bad and you walk in, let's do this, bitch. And they're like, oh, whoa, that's good. Hey, I watched that show too. It can connect you to somebody instantly, you know.
So there is a certain element of escapism into another person, into another life, which is kind of similar to jumping out of a plane. It's just kind of jumping out of your regular life for a little while.
Yeah, all of that acting is, you know, you want to forget about your own sort of physical, emotional limitations and just play for a while and then put it into somebody else.
I've heard Kevin Pollak interviewed where he talks about
Once he sees somebody do an impression of someone famous, it's easier for him to then do an impression of that person.
Yeah, it's because it's Alan Arkin, Kevin. Don't do this. Why are you doing this, Kevin? That's me doing Kevin Pollak, doing Alan Arkin. So, touche. It fell back on you, didn't it, Kevin? Yeah, you know, it's like, it almost takes somebody doing that to go, oh, yeah, I could do it. Even when I was watching Chris Berman, 2 minutes, I was watching Caliendo. I can't do it yet, but I'm like, oh, there's a shortcut I wasn't thinking about. Huh. He's got the eyes. He's got the hands, the expressions. And there we go, for the final, 2 minutes. It's like, oh, yeah, I could probably learn to do that. Aaron Paul was just, I didn't know. I just started watching, and I was watching Netflix. So I was watching 4 or 5 episodes at a time. And so I was like, yes, cooking, the body language. I can do this, bitch. I just thought, oh, yeah, I could discover it. I could do it. So, yeah, when ironically, where I saw Titus Wolliver do his Pacino impressions was on a show where he was being interviewed by Kevin Pollak.
Uh-huh.
And you could see Pollak watching him going, oh, yeah, okay, yeah, that's how you do it. So I think that happens. Yeah, somebody else paves the way for you, and then you're able to do it.
I never would have thought about picking up the voice has so much to do with studying the body and studying the facial movements.
It should come inside out like that. It really does. I'm trying to think of others. You know, like I said, if it's not an actual impression of a real Scottish star, if you're just doing a person that you observe, you're gonna watch that and look at their face, like I said. But yeah, it does. It's a lot of study there, but it's because you want to do it. These voice actors that I hang out with, there's a guy, James Arnold Taylor, that's like 5'5". And a 125, and his Fred Flintstone body. This is like, where is that coming from?
Uh-huh.
Dude, it's amazing. Jeff Bennett, Eric Bauza does Jeff Bridges and Chris Rock, and these guys are phenomenal. Fred Tatasciore, he does Dustin Hoffman in Kung Fu Panda, the series. He's imitating, who does Dustin Hoffman? Not the Elaine, but just a normal Dustin Hoffman. It's like, holy shit. These guys are masters.
Can you see where people are doing it wrong also? Do you ever watch someone doing an impression like, oh, I see where they're doing it wrong.
Yeah.
I could tell them. I could tweak that.
Yeah. You definitely, you're like, oh, you're trying too hard with that one. You know, Dana Carvey always had his caricatures of impressions, you know. Uh-huh. Not going to do it. Being prudent. It wasn't George Bush exactly uh-huh. to a T, but it was a good characterization of it. But yeah, you can see where some are like, you're a little off on that. You're not that good.
How long does it take you to develop an impression to the point where you're satisfied?
I don't know. With Billy Crystal, it just took many, many. With Mike Wazowski, it took a lot of. I don't consider that impression. I consider that like a dead-on, hopefully, sound-alike. You know, because this is my job, to fool people into thinking, hey, welcome to Disney World. You got 5 more minutes in line. You know, to make them think that that's Mike Wazowski instead of a guy trying to do an impression of Mike Wazowski. You know, the Aaron Paul, yes, it's not dead on, but it's close. Probably took me 10 episodes, 2 weeks of walking around the house going, yo, and my wife going, please, stop. Stop. Yo, bitch, I'll stop what I want.
What makes somebody harder to impersonate?
I think it might be their tone or their bass. You know, if they're an octave that I can't get to, that makes it harder. If they're maybe somebody you haven't seen before, that they're just on radio or just their music that you're not watching as much. And I don't know. Sometimes they're just out of your range. Somebody goes, can you do this? Nope. Like, for example, hey, Mo, do me a favor, huh, Homer? Get rid of those beers, would you? Hey, Simpson, it's Chief Wiggum. Those are your taillights. Mm-hmm. You know, that Hank Azaria's tenor is going to be a lot easier for me than go, oh, geez, Mark, you stupid oaf. Castellaneta's got more of a bass. I won't be able to get that bass.
So it's just mostly vocal.
It's vocal, yeah.
There aren't people that aren't doing enough with their face.
Yeah. Yeah. Come on, Homer, do me a favor, would you? That's what could make it harder, when you just say, you know what? They're out of my range. I can't get that high. I can't get that deep. So.
All right. Well, you want to? Should we take a look at our philosopher?
Yeah, absolutely.
The guy Alex picked out for you is Ludwig Wittgenstein. Is that how you'd say that?
Yeah, Alex.
Wittgenstein.
Wittgenstein.
Okay.
Probably.
Yeah, well, he's from Austria-Hungary, so he got the accent right.
Yeah.
I think you should be probably more sympathetic to harder names than me, because you have a harder name to say than mine.
Al is Rocky.
Tougher than Lobel.
A little bit.
So maybe
more
is there,
symbolic.
Is there a kinship with the tougher name?
Yeah.
Tougher name people?
Absolutely.
I'm not. It's a club I'm not a part of.
You should be proud. My daughter will have to go through it. Riley, what's your last name? Al-Rocky. Oh, boy.
And that you said that name was comes from Spain?
Comes from Spain. Yeah, the Jewish Spaniards that during the Inquisition left rather than go along with that crazy plan. And my dad's lineage was Spain, Turkey, France, Argentina.
Ah, see, I have family that left Spain also in the Inquisition. But I guess they dropped the name and replaced it at some point.
Yeah.
They're like, all right, this is too tough. Life is tough enough when you're getting kicked out of Spain and running around Italy and Turkey and Morocco.
Yeah.
Alex said, because Carlos is great at impressions, I picked a philosopher who talked about empathy through language. Feeling what someone else is feeling in order to understand them, which we talked about a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Because impressions require a certain amount of putting yourself in someone else's shoes. All right, before even looking at this, we kind of covered some of that idea. Wittgenstein, is that
Wittgenstein.
Wittgenstein. Let me study the way you say that.
Wittgenstein, I think.
I'm looking at your lips now to try. I'm going to start watching people's lips now.
I'll tell you, watch your face.
Wittgenstein says that to understand language, we must have empathy to the speaker.
Mm-hmm.
If we encountered a lion and we figured out that roar meant zebra and roar meant a lame zebra, we could talk, but we could never fully get what he means. We could never comprehend lion ethics, politics, or the true meaning of his words because we never lived a lion's life.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of what I was asking you. About your character from Reno 911.
Mm-hmm.
You don't really get to live his life in a way.
But you get to observe people that are sad, people that you met in your life before, and make that an amalgam of characters that you've met and put it into one. You've met the sad guy before, and a little bit of Barney Fife. Well, I don't need anybody. I'll just go home and spend a nice quiet evening by myself. Something I enjoy doing. Yeah, and then you're like, no, you don't. That's subtext, dude. You're alone. So you can observe people in your life like that, like, oh, man, I remember this custodian when I was little, or I remember this one guy who would try to pretend he's tough, and underneath he's a softie, all those kind of things.
Right.
So, yeah, there was that empathy. I've always been empathetic to people, stoners, and I was a jock who would be friends with stoners, or if somebody was walking across the quad and the cool guys were making fun of him, I'm like, why? Leave him alone, because I was shorter when I still am short, but I was the short guy, but I was scrappy, you know, like, nay, don't make fun of him. So
that's interesting. So to do a character, you need a certain amount of empathy.
I think so. To understand a baby, you need empathy. Instead of that fucking baby's goddamn it, it's always crying. It's like, well, what do you think is wrong?
Uh-huh.
Then now, as a parent, you know, it's like, well, she's dry. She doesn't have any poop. She doesn't have a fever. She's hungry. You know?
It really goes back to what Melissa was saying, about having to like the person. You have to be empathetic to them.
Yeah, even if they're a dark character, you know.
You can't hate them and understand them.
I had a census taker where I had his with some fava beans, the nice Chianti. He's a despicable character, but he's your empathy. There's some empathy for the guy because he's intelligent, he's smart, he's penned up, he's controlled, and he's helping Jodie Foster's character. So there's something about him you like.
When I do my Israeli character, which you've seen me do, I always feel like I have to sort of play psychologist to him a little bit to understand.
Yeah.
I guess you kind of have to become your character's psychologist.
Because as I recall that character, he's pretty forward, pretty confident, brash.
Yeah.
This is who I am. What are you going to do?
Yeah.
You get mad at me? Why are you mad?
Yeah,
Something wrong with you, not me.
Right.
Yeah, you like people like that. Yeah, you're like, there's a quality to that I really like. I have my neighbor Bartan, who's Armenian.
Mm-hmm.
Come, Carl, we drink. Why you stop drinking? We drink more. I go to Vegas with my friends. It's going to be guys' night. We go crazy, go to Mandalay Bay. It's going to be great. My son Michael, good tennis player. You know, he's just full of joie de vivre. He's likable. He's just a likable guy. Sergio next door
from Mexico. Very Americanized. Now his kids are very Americanized. But Sergio's like, oh, I don't know. Just closing the shop. We're going to Laughlin again. So easy going. You know, there's like there's something really cool about that, you know.
I'm jealous of those guys.
Yeah.
I see those guys. How is life such a breeze for you almost?
They are, Jack Palance's character in City Slickers, you know, they, just one thing. I can't just do the one thing. My life is more complex than that. Well, then you got to try to simplify it.
Yeah.
I can't. I'm an actor. I want to be everything. I want to be liked. I want to make money. I want to be popular. I want to be sane. But sane, toss that out the window.
Right. I'll read you a little bit about Ludwig Wittgenstein, The Life and Times.
Mm-hmm.
Ludwig Joseph Johann Wittgenstein. Say it again for me, will you? Wittgenstein? Wittgenstein?
Wittgenstein.
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 It's the V. You're changing the W to the V, and that's what's making it work. Wittgenstein.
Schwarzenegger. Wittgenstein.
Wittgenstein. It's like Indians do that, too.
Yeah, Wittgenstein.
Wittgenstein?
We're watching Life of Pi. I play a character named Manesh on Chosen, but he's not quite Indian. He's more American. He's a college student. Very excited. I just had sex with a girl 13 times.
Yeah.
This is wonderful.
I once managed an Indian restaurant.
Oh, did you?
Yeah. Everyone who came in was named Patel.
Patel?
Patel. Oh, Mr. Patel, welcome for lunch. Mr. Patel, oh, you're here for lunch. I don't know why that still sticks with me. Just
That's funny.
Oh, the Patels are back. The Patels didn't pay their tab.
The Patels never left.
The Patels are great tippers. The Patels are the cheapest people in town.
Damn those Patels.
Ludwig lived from April 26th, 1889 to April 29th, 1951.
Wow.
He was an Austrian-British philosopher who worked primarily in logic, the philosophy of mathematics, the philosophy of mind, and the philosophy of language. From 1939 to 1947, Wittgenstein taught at the University of Cambridge. During his lifetime, he published just one slim book. I didn't call it a slim book.
That one slim book.
Just a slim book. 75-page Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus in 1921. One article, one book review, and a children's dictionary. His voluminous manuscripts were edited and published posthumously. Philosophical Investigations appeared as a book in 1953, and by the end of the century, it was considered an important modern classic. Philosopher Bertrand Russell described Wittgenstein as the most perfect example I've ever known of genius as traditionally conceived, passionate, profound, intense, and dominating. He was born in Vienna into one of Europe's richest families. He inherited a large fortune, so he would have that, the first accent, rather than the British accent. He was born in,
Vienna.
In Vienna. He was born in Vienna into one of Europe's richest families. He inherited a large fortune from his father in 1913. He gave some considerable sums to poor artists. In a period of severe personal depression after the First World War, he then gave away his entire fortune to his brothers and sisters. Three of his brothers committed suicide. Wow, three of his brothers committed suicide. That's a lot. That's bad. That's definitely something genetic or chemical.
Maybe Ludwig von Beethoven type of parenting where there was a lot of beatings and discipline. So who knows? I wonder if it's related to his parenting.
Yeah.
And how maybe philosophy helped him escape, but who knows?
Yeah, I wonder. I guess by the third time you have a brother commit suicide, it can't hit you the same anymore. You're like, well, that's just a thing we do in our family.
Yeah, it always happens in threes.
With Wittgenstein contemplating it, too. Oh, so he thought about it.
He thought about it.
You know, it's the family business.
It's the family business.
He left academia several times, serving as an officer on the front line during World War I.
Wow.
Where he was decorated a number of times for his courage, teaching in schools in remote Austrian villages, where he encountered controversy for hitting children when they made mistakes in mathematics. Probably your theory. He was probably hit, and then he hit other kids. And working during World War II as a hospital porter in London, where he told patients not to take the drugs they were prescribed, and where he largely managed to keep secret the fact that he was one of the world's most famous philosophers.
Wow.
It's kind of like Andy Kaufman working at the deli.
That's right, at Jerry's Deli. Yeah. Bussing tables.
You described philosophy, however, as the only work that gives me real satisfaction. His philosophy is often divided into an early period exemplified by the Tractatus and the later period articulated in the Philosophical Investigations. The early Wittgenstein was concerned with the logical relationship between propositions and the world, and believed that by providing an account of the logic underlying this relationship, he had solved all philosophical problems. However, even his early period reveals an underlying mysticism, stating that words reach out to reference. Reference? Is that right? Reference. Reference?
Is it with a V? Reverence or
no,
reference?
It's reference. R-E-F-E-R-E-N-T-S. I don't know that word. Reference, without teaching them. The later Wittgenstein rejected many of the assumptions of the Tractatus, arguing that the meaning of the words is constituted by the function they perform within any given language game. Wittgenstein's influence has been felt in nearly every field of the humanities and social sciences, yet there are widely diverging interpretations of his thought. In the words of his friend and colleague George Henrik von Wright, he was of the opinion that his ideas were generally misunderstood and distorted, even by those who professed to be his disciples. He doubted he would be better understood in the future. He once said he felt as though he were writing for people who would think in a different way, breathe a different air in life from that of the present-day men. And then he almost killed himself again.
Mm-hmm.
But he didn't want to be too much like his brothers.
One of the most eloquent notes ever left. Wittgenstein, writing a 75-page book. That, to me, exemplifies somebody that's pretty brilliant. It's like, I don't need volumes of books and volume one and one. I've got this down to 75 pages.
Right.
All you need to know, all you ever need to think, the nature of man is this. We will always react in this way. I think that's pretty staggering to say. I'm just gonna leave this behind.
Right.
That's all you need. It's like,
but you're probably not gonna get it.
The greatest advice from the greatest comic ever in the world, just written on a cocktail napkin. This is all you need to know. Scribble, scribble. What? Be yourself. What?
You think the rest of this stuff is probably just too wordy and trying to cover up a lack of knowledge?
Yeah. I was trying to hear that. I guess he weighed the importance on words and how they affect people, where they come from, that every probably minuscule word that we use to communicate has meaning. That's what I'm deriving from that. And they're not wasted.
Mm-hmm.
They are an attempt, as in sort of acting in scenes, to get across our point of view and have whoever on the other end understand and agree with them so that we don't always engage in conflict.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the scenes seems to be that. I think it's pretty honorable that he worked in a hot, besides the hitting of kids as a teacher.
The beating of the kids, yeah.
Not so good, but yeah. Spare the rod, spoil the child. That's the British part of him, right?
But he was telling people not to take their pills. I don't know if that is honorable.
It gets into that weird sort of Christian Science, right? Where, you know, don't immunize your kids or whatever. But maybe not. Maybe it's the whole Jack Nicholson in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Hey, man, they're trying to, that ratchet's trying to poison you, man. Don't do it, chief. Maybe it was the bad stuff. Maybe it's something like, you don't need this, you know? You can heal yourself.
What do you think it is about some guys like Jack Nicholson, Christopher Walken, that so many people do impersonate them? What is it that makes them more impersonable?
I think that it's they're a dying breed. Back in an era where actors could act in longer scenes, where they probably would interpret the writers more. The directors would back off and let them be who they are. And them growing up in a time where theater was probably a little bit more important than acting for film. So I think they're just more well-rounded, salty guys. And they're from interesting places. I don't know where Nicholson's from, but I think Walken was from Brooklyn. But I don't know. They're already characters. They don't have to do much.
Mm-hmm.
You can read a phone book now. You know, why not? Start with A, end with Z, alphabet. Yeah. It's nice, alphabet. It's good. Letters put together, strong, to make words is what we want to do. What games? Scrabble. Oh, Scrabble. You know, I don't know. They're just so watchable. Mm-hmm. They're lived in, you know. Mm-hmm. It's hard to watch some of these movies. Like, Chris Pine is a fine actor, you know. He's in a new movie with the Paul Ryan thing or whatever. Not Paul Ryan, that's our... The James, you know, the series with Kevin Costner now. But it just doesn't have the weight that these guys have. Brad Pitt's getting there. You know, he's getting more leathery, older.
Yeah.
And he's living an interesting life. And but, yeah, there's something about those guys. They're like just like an old baseball mitt.
Is Brad Pitt somebody who would be tough to impersonate?
Yeah, I can't. I know there's probably somebody out there that can do him.
Because
he's got to be.
Maybe he's not emoting
he's
enough.
He's kind of neutral. He's a Midwestern guy, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know. I can't. That's a guy I couldn't handle. I'd probably have to watch a lot of him. But he's probably bassier than I am, too. I don't know. I don't do Brad Pitt. And I'm proud that I'm able to admit that.
Do you want to read a bit of Wittgenstein first?
Wittgenstein, sure. For a large class of cases, though not for all, in which we employ the word meaning, it can be defined thus. The meaning of a word is its use in the language. And the meaning of a name is sometimes explained by pointing to its bearer. So the meaning of the word is relative to what we know about it.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, we could go to the Amazon and go, fuck, you know, and Billy Connolly's have a bit about that. There's something universal about, I don't care if you went to Africa and you land in Nairobi, right, or whatever, and you're at the baggage claim and you see this guy, you don't even speak the language, and he's got your bag and he's playing with it, you look over and you go, you, fuck off. He's going to know what you mean just by the tone. That's universal fuck off. Everybody understands fuck off.
Right.
But, yeah, I would say that, yeah, the meaning of a word is relative to knowing what it means in your own language. You could just say, freaking jackass, son of a bitch, cocksucker. And the Amazon are like, are you hungry? Do you need to sleep? No, I'm angry. Right. Can't you tell? No.
And a word like fuck is a good one because it's got multiple meanings. So if you only knew one, you know, the word has less.
It's a verb. It's an adjective. Yeah, it does.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we give a word meaning in a language and we define it. I hate you. I hate. It's like, it can be so permeating and so vicious.
Mm-hmm.
I fucking hate you.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I hate you.
I took it
as opposed to, like, I hate Brussels sprouts.
Right, right.
There's not the same level of hate for a food that there is for a person.
But there's also not the same level of love. You can't really love Brussels sprouts the way you'd love a woman or anyone.
Well, it can aid in the act of love.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you want to put some Brussels sprouts and like hide them like Easter eggs on a woman's body, that can happen. But yeah, it's relative.
The way we love Brussels sprouts is we destroy them with our teeth. You can't really love it and destroy it. Right.
Well, you can be destroyed by love. It can be all-consuming. That's very, very deep, man.
In this case, you're destroying love, or I guess the thing is being destroyed by love.
Lust destroys love, clouds you.
Can you be in lust and in love at the same time?
Yeah, but then one of them fades, and I think it's lust turns into love because then it turns into, all right, you gotta go to the doctor. You take care of the kids. You forgot the fucking groceries. I hate you, piece of shit. I never did that. Yes, you did. It's because love is like good and bad and worst and best. And lust is bereft of that. Lust is like, I don't care what you do. Let's just fuck. So one happens and one evolves into another. But yeah, there can be lust after love.
Yeah.
Like, shit, you look good tonight. Holy shit. Let's do it. I just noticed
and
something.
And at that point, the love fades a little bit. So it makes
and you
the
just
lust.
Go for the animal stuff. And then... Then like you clean the spot, you clean it. No, I'm fucking tired. All right, you'll do it in the morning.
Yeah. See, nobody ever says I lust you either.
I lust you.
You can say I love you, but you never say I lust.
I'm so in lust with lust. Lust me do. You know I lust you. So please lust me too.
Lust because it's never spoken.
Yeah.
You have to trust it.
Lust means never having to say I'll call you in the morning.
You can say I love you and be like, I don't know if the person really loves me.
Lust story.
But nobody can say I lust you. You either know it or it doesn't.
Yeah.
So maybe it's truer in a way.
It is truer. Because it's only for the moment. It's fleeting.
Hmm.
It's fleeting.
And going back to these words and and characters, when you give a character certain words, you are shaping who the character is. You might have a character and say, oh, he'd never say that. Basically, you're saying that word is not part of his character.
Yeah, even as he says, the name is in the meaning of the beholder of that name. If I want to call myself James and the way I say it, well, my name's James. Hey, man, I'm James. No, James. Hard, short, curse.
Do you think I could change the kind of Danny I am by the way I say the word Danny?
You could be the Shining Danny. Danny! When you're being chased through the
can't
shrubs
introduce
in the winter.
Like that.
Yeah, I'm Danny! Danny Thomas, you know, very vibrant guy.
Yeah.
Gave back a lot to his community. Danny Granger on the Indiana Pacers. Yeah, Danny's kind of, Danny is a sunny name to me. It's the NNY and the A.
My real name is Daniel. I changed it to Danny when I was in like fourth or fifth grade.
Daniel seems deeper, though. I'm Daniel.
Yeah, I couldn't deal with that depth.
Yeah, no, just call me Danny. Danny sounds, it's more, it's friendlier. It's like I'd buy a car from Danny.
Right.
I wouldn't buy a car from Daniel.
Interesting.
Yeah.
You think Daniel's up to something?
Daniel's too smart. He's getting something over on me. I paid too much for this car, but Danny wouldn't lie to me.
Danny's a good guy. He's a neighborhood guy.
Danny's a neighborhood guy.
Let's do the quotes.
Let's do the quotes. If a lion could speak, we could not understand him.
He keeps going back to these lions.
Yeah. I think what he means is the depth of their experience of being on this earth for so many years and seeing through their eyes. A lion could speak, but we could not see through their eyes. It's almost like the question of race. A black person could talk to you about being pulled over, about driving while black, about when I go into a store, people look at me, and we could go, well, maybe you should just dress nicer. It's like, no, you don't get it. You just don't get it. You can't, you can empathize with me, but you cannot experience what I experience because you're not black. I'm not saying that you're bad or whatever. I'm just saying that it is what it is.
Yeah.
You know? So that's what I think he's saying. It's like, you can't feel what the lion is feeling. You can't really understand what that lion is saying. And the lion's just saying, I want that gazelle. And I'm not going to hunt. The females are going to hunt. He could be talking about a female lion. And it's weird. If a lion could speak, I automatically went to a lion with a mane. Because it doesn't say lioness. But I think this is the species of lion, which is lion.
Yeah. I went to Narnia with it.
Did you?
Yeah. All right, let's go to our next quote here.
The limits of my language means the limits of my world. I would concur with that. Concur, Mr. Kincaid. To the extent that if we cannot go beyond just spoken word, then we are falling short of something. In other words, truly experiencing something. You can experience a lot of things without language and deepen your world. If I'm limited to just talking about things or expressing myself in just one idiom, then I'm not truly reaching my potential. You know, the question of being bilingual, of speaking Spanish, speaking another language, or if you speak Hebrew or whatever, that's, you're expanding your world.
And some languages don't have certain words for certain things. Like, I think there's no word, I mean, people use the word mazal in Hebrew for luck, but I don't think it actually means luck. Like, I don't think there is really a word that means luck, because I don't think it's really a Jewish concept, luck. It's more based on fate.
Yeah.
So the culture will dictate the language with its beliefs.
Yeah.
So in a certain way, it works probably in reverse. When you learn the language without even knowing it, you're learning the beliefs of the culture and you're taking them on.
Yeah, everything was condensed into all the beliefs, all the faith is condensed into pushing it out into this set of tools for you to use verbally, and then it will encompass all that precedes it. I think there's an expression in Spanish my mom used to say. There's a thing on the online YouTube called El Tano Pasman. Tano meaning Italian in Argentinian, watching a soccer game, River Plate, and he keeps swearing at the TV, and it's la puta que te parió carajo, la puta que te parió carajo, means the bitch that gave you birth, god damn it. And it just doesn't, it's a quintessential Argentinian expression. It's different from a Mexican or Puerto Rican expression. It's quintessentially Argentinian. La puta que te parió, la concha de su madre. It is so Italian Argentinian.
Yeah.
Definitive. Not Mexican, not Cuban, not Dominican, Argentinian.
Yeah.
And so I grew up listening to that. I grew up with John and Mary Haney and Carlos. Come down, Carlos. And this is Uncle Danny and Auntie Liz. There were so many cultures coming at me that I could imitate and kind of soak in, you know. Different.
I think it's kind of, my theory is that it's probably somewhat genetic. I think my ability to do characters and your ability to do impressions and like Hank Azaria, I think it has to do with Sephardic roots.
Yeah, you had to be other people.
You had to be some other, like conversos and everybody. You're living a false identity for so many years, we probably got pretty good at switching around identity.
You had to, yeah. I mean, you could look like anybody else, you know. I could look Italian. You could look, you almost could look...
I get Italian all the time.
You get Italian, yeah.
I shouldn't have stopped you because I was curious to see where you went with it.
You could even be light Arabic.
Yeah, yeah. Oh yeah. People.
Well, Middle Eastern,
always
right?
Always say light Arabic.
Yeah, light Arabic. Not Arabic light.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah. A third less hijackings. See, that's racist.
This guy's a little too heavy Arabic. You got any lighter Arabic around?
Light Arabic.
Yes, hello, my friend. Softer Arabic.
You could be from Bulgaria.
Yeah, yeah.
You could be Armenian. You look Armenian.
Oh, good. So I've got a good bunch of places to hide.
Danny Labeldashian. My friend.
It's good to know where to run to if the shit goes down.
If the shit goes down, just go to Glendale. You'll fit right in.
I think we have one more quote and even a bonus quote here today.
We have, whereof one cannot speak, thereof one must be silent. That's almost like, hey, if you don't know what you're saying, shut the fuck up. that's like a mob quote.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
That's De Niro.
Maybe a bit of shut up. You're going to say something, don't say something because you're too fucking stupid and this ain't the arena for it.
Yeah.
So, whereof one cannot speak, thereof one must be silent. Basically, shut the fuck up.
Yeah.
Let me handle it.
Don't be a rat.
Yeah. Are you going across the border into Mexico? Mm-hmm. Hey, man, I'll get us out of it. No, silencio. Hola, ¿qué tal? Estamos con familia en México. I'll handle this, man. I think that's what that means.
Yeah.
And the bonus quote. A serious and good philosophical work could be written consisting entirely of jokes. Wow. I suppose that could be. You aforementioned Woody Allen.
Yeah.
I absolutely think so, because jokes are turning pain into... humor and a way to deal with life. Louis C.K., you know?
Right.
All those people. Chris Rock, you know? Yeah, his philosophical, one of his great philosophical things. Your job as a parent of daughters,
I knew you were gonna go with
is
that
to keep her off the pole. I mean, that's so quotable.
Yeah.
And so poignant and so philosophical.
Right.
You know? In the end, as a parent, you don't want your daughter ending up there. How can I put this into a joke?
Right.
The joke that I have about, you know, my love of strangers being more important than the love of my daughter. You know, you put that into a joke.
Which is why I think they should remove, like, the monkey bars and a bunch of other things from the playground. Anything with a pole in it.
That's true.
They should take out.
Yeah. Just make it lateral, like a ballet pole.
Yeah.
Just lateral poles are fine. Vertical poles.
Just use beams.
Beams, yeah, use beams.
That's a bit too poly for me. Right.
Although, God, you know, realize the money you could make with gymnastic strippers on beams.
Yeah.
Instead of poles. You're used
to seeing Soleil, right?
Strip Soleil. I like that.
Yeah. They just have to combine the two cultures that are going on in Vegas, you know?
Yes, it's just the Montreal Canadiens and thugs.
Just take the strip club
and pimps
and the art and merge them together.
Pimp de Soleil.
Yeah, for the higher brow, the more, what's the word? The better palate.
The better palate. There we go with the word.
The better palate. It's not the word. the
better Patels.
The more distinctive palate, or
distinguished
guest. Distinguished.
Saying at the Araya or the Aria Hotel.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, I'd like my strippers to be able to do something artsy.
Yes. Artsy strippers, but paint it and then make paintings with that certain area of the body.
Yeah. What about a strippers?
There's got to be some vaginal art somewhere where somebody, you know, and penis art where somebody dips their genitals in paint and just lays it on paper or canvas.
Yeah.
That's got to exist. That's got to be NEA funded.
Right. And there's got to be someone who gets off to it, too.
Absolutely.
I can't get off to the real thing. I only like the paintings, the penis paintings.
The penis paintings and the vag paintings.
Don't show me an actual penis.
Don't show me. That's gross.
Disgusting.
Disgusting.
It's the art that does it for me.
Yeah, man.
I lust the fuck out of it.
I lust the fuck out of it.
Thanks so much for doing
this
show.
Yeah, thank
Carlos.
You, man. Thank
I
you.
Really appreciate
thank you, Danny.
It.
Daniel, this is great. And you know what? At this point, whereof one cannot speak, thereof one must be silent.
Thanks. All right, everybody, that's our show for today. Thank you so much for tuning in. Thank you again to Carlos Alazraki, and thank you to Stand Up Records and Dan Schlissel for making this such a great year. Happy 2015, everybody. Thank you for being with the show once again. Go check out the website, even if it's just to look at some pictures. It's moderndayphilosophers.net, and you can make a donation there. And I want to thank again the good people at Tweaked Audio, tweakedaudio.com, whom for the past year have been providing headphones to donors. Even though the promotion is over, you can still pick up a pair at their website and use promo code MDP and get 1/3 off plus free shipping and a lifetime guarantee, I think it is, or warranty. I never checked up on that. I should really look into that. Anyway, that's it, everybody. Email me at thecomical@yahoo.com. Say hello. Wish me a happy new year. I'll write you back. I can't wait to hear from you. Till next week. I'm Danny LaBelle, live in Jerusalem. Shalom!